we present the News Quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Hello! And welcome to the News Quiz. We start with a cutting from the German tabloid The Bild, read by Zeb Soans.
The progression of wind energy trade fair continues today as planned, after it was necessary to evacuate the lightweight exhibition halls yesterday due to a cyclone.
Our thanks to Thomas Warden for sending that in. Now let's meet the teams. Really welcome first on my right, Jeremy Hardy and Times columnist Daniel Finkelstein. And opposite them on my left, Sarah Kendall and Lucy Porter. Jeremy, which secretary hasn't been taking their boss's dictation?
Sadly, it falls to me to mention the name of Boris Johnson. Basically, the Conservative Party has a really elaborate way of choosing a leader. You start with a basis of disloyalty towards the leader, and then you call a referendum into Britain's membership of the European Union, in which one of the main contenders blatantly lies about the benefits of Brexit, and in fact carries on using the same lie into the future. And then that side wins the referendum, and then there's a kind of weird sort of Mexican standoff where everyone's dead and then Theresa May pops up unscathed from behind a bullet-strewn counter and then did a really weird thing because Boris Johnson had been executed for her by Michael Gove and she then gave him the job of Foreign Secretary, which storing up... I mean, you just think, why would you... You know there's going to be problems. The weird thing about Theresa May is she's... Not only is she incredibly ambitious and scheming and calculating, but she's really bad at it. She's like a homeopathic poisoner. So now she's got the problem that he's just humiliating her at every turn. She's got to make a speech in Florence. She's like the woman at the beginning of a horror film that's looking for the dog, and the dog's run away, and then there's a weird yelping sound, and the dog goes silent, and she decides to go looking for the dog. And it's 3 minutes into the horror film, and you're just thinking, bye-bye, Theresa. We don't know what she's going to say, because this show is being recorded in 1994. But apparently she's going to be... warm and generous? Stable and warm? Flanagan and Allen? Basically, when Theresa May puts together two adjectives with an and in the middle, you know she's in trouble.
Well, one of the things she might be doing is paying... Well, offering. I'm not saying it's a good offer, but offering 20 million... Or is it 20 billion? I mean, one of the billion. Big ones. It's a billion.
A billion though. Or million. It's enough.
Billion or I mean, it's... Yeah, yeah. Look after the millions and the billions look after themselves.
I just love that thing with the 350 million, because when he was challenged about it, he said he wasn't going to... We weren't going to get it. We were going to take control of it.
Yeah.
And I'm just looking forward to coming home to my wife and saying, you know, I've got £10 million of salary this year. We're not actually going to be paid it, but we are going to take control of it.
It's a bit like hijacking a plane. It's not mine, but I'm going to crash it.
You can actually travel once on a plane with Boris Johnson and Michael Gove at the back of a small private plane. And basically, there we were over the Atlantic in the middle of nowhere, possibly going to crash. And I've now realised it wasn't a trip, it was a metaphor.
Boris had to change his flight, didn't he, so that he could be on a plane with Theresa.
A very nice image, the idea of Boris being forced to get the same plane as Theresa. I mean, it must have looked like... I think all parents will know the idea, you know, seeing an incredibly stressed mother with an unruly toddler, basically. She's definitely got to placate with offers of,
he's
of chocolate.
Sticking peanuts up his nose.
Yeah. Boris, stop kicking the seat in front of you.
Yeah.
Stop
it. Hammering on the door of the, you know, the cockpit and so forth.
I kind of like the fact that Boris now, he's launched his kind of, hang on, this is my vision for Brexit. This is my 10-point plan. And it's like, well, it has taken you over a year to come up with it. And, you know, because actually, if you remember the day after the vote, I mean, Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, they had that ashen face look of, like, you know, there's a dead stripper in the next room, you know?
I'm always really suspicious in politics when anyone comes up with a 10-point plan. Because if you'd actually had a real plan, what are the chances it would have exactly 10 points, right? It would have 7 points, wouldn't it? Or 11 points. So when someone comes up with a 10-point plan, you can be pretty sure they've just made it up.
And it is Boris going, oh, 10 looks good next to my name, doesn't it?
I think they're both history, I think. I mean, they're May and Johnson are trapped in this sort of abusive codependent relationship, like Joan Crawford and Bette Davis in Whatever Happened to David Jones. But they're both finished. It's not going to be either of them who leads the part. I don't even think it will be. Zoe the other week said Rees-Mogg is like a Dickens character, but I think even Dickens would say, no one's going to believe this dick. I mean, it's... I'll scrap Mr. Povgrinder. It'll probably be... I think it'll probably be Ruth Davidson, because she's revived the Tories in Scotland. I mean, and she's done amazingly well because she's an out gay woman. I'm not sure many Scottish Conservatives know what a lesbian is, in fairness. Never been to Lebanon myself, but apparently that Arabs are fine horse people and very good with falcons. And she looks like a practical lassie, doesn't she? No doubt a keen golfer.
Basically, David Cameron called the referendum in order to stop Tory infighting. Well, that has gone swimmingly, hasn't it? That's absolute result for that one.
But yeah, it does feel like Theresa May can... will just keep going. I don't know what... She reminds me... I once broke up with a guy and I thought the conversation had gone in the direction of we've broken up, and then he went, OK, and then he said, so what are we having for dinner tonight? And I just kind of went, oh, OK... And then he just stayed and he didn't go. And I think it would be impossible to break up with Theresa May in the same way. I think you go, it's over, and she'd go, OK, but I'm still your Prime Minister, right?
Well, David Davis is doing a good job, Danny?
The thing is, I think it's intrinsically really, really difficult.
People have known it was going
to be. In other words, I'm not sure it's possible to do a good job at it. If I did do that, then I might have voted for it, but as I didn't think that, I didn't vote for it. So everyone concentrates on whether he's doing it really well, but in my view, you know, it's one of Baldrick's cunning plans, Brexit. I don't think this is a stupid approach to solving an almost insoluble problem.
It's like when you've parked in a really tight parking space. I think for David Davis, it's like he's trying to get out of the parking space and there's always, like, a crowd of blokes turn up and tell you how you should be doing it.
You can make an argument that says it was a bad idea to join the EU, but it's one of those things that once you're in, it's probably impossible to get out. It's like it would be a bad idea to get a pacemaker from Wix, but an even worse idea to try and remove it yourself.
This is Theresa May's forthcoming Brexit speech in Florence. We're told not to expect an immediate breakthrough as a result of the speech, for which I think I speak for every man, woman and child in this country when I say, Christ. May is expected to offer €20 billion over 2 years for access to the single market, which, as an opening move, seems about as confident and clear-minded as moving your king's pawn onto a triple word score and shouting, house, twist, snap, buckaroo! In The Telegraph, Boris brought up once again the £350 million a week we could supposedly spend on the NHS, one of two largely discredited figures mentioned in the article, if you also count the author. Boris set out his own vision of Brexit, despite not being part of the official negotiating team. As part of the Foreign Office reorganisation, he's currently only supposed to focus on supermarket openings, church fetes, children's parties and horseplay. Responding to the article, Theresa May said, Boris is Boris, notably refraining from saying it a third time in case he appeared behind her and took her away to the land of the goblins. Home Secretary Amber Rudd openly criticised Boris, which is a departure for Cabinet colleagues who normally just sit opposite each other in an atmosphere of festering silent hatred that more usually accompanies the third decade of a marriage. When you're just waiting for one of you to die and you're not really bothered which of you it is. Amber Rudd accused the Foreign Secretary of backseat driving, which is unfair as it implies he has something helpful to contribute. He's more like a dog that howls along to the radio then tries to climb out of the window every time you stop at the traffic lights. Three points to Jeremy. Sarah, who's not flying in the face of adversity?
Ryanair, they've had to cancel thousands of flights because they haven't got enough pilots, crucial part of the airline business structure. And it turns out that this is sort of coming out in the wash, that there's a very unhappy work culture in at Ryanair, that they're underpaid and overworked. And it's just one of those stories that you read and you kind of think there are certain professions where it's really vital that the people employed are well-rested and well-paid. And I just think airline pilot is one of them. Like, I'm a comedian. If I'm overtired, that's okay. Like, I've never got off stage and gone, oh, it's a little bit exhausted tonight and the entire front row is dead. I mugged up a joke about escalators and 23 souls perished. So, you know, like, I think we recognise that there are certain jobs. Like, that's why we pay nurses and teachers so well. Because we've acknowledged the importance of what they do.
What they could do is make pilots one of the frills, you know, that the passengers have to pay more for. That's what budget airlines do. You can fly to America for £1, but you have to pay more if you want a seat or luggage or an engine. So they could do that with the pilots, couldn't they? But, I mean, the thing about pilots being rested is they're so pissed that I don't know, it makes that much difference. I mean, why do you think they have automatic pilot? You know, the people flying the planes are so out of it. They've got to press that button where, you know, like, I've seen an airplane, I know how these things work. The inflatable pilot takes over and lands the plane. That's how it works. It's not like the 633 squadron anymore.
Yeah. I mean, most of it's sort of done remotely. That's why it takes so long for the trolley to come round, because they are absolutely hoovering it all up in there, aren't they?
They said it's all about the pilots' holiday raters. So you think, well, but why don't they just publish where the pilots are going on holiday and then they could just fly there and then problem solved? Because I bet pilots go on really nice places on holiday, because they know where's good to go, don't they? I reckon going on holiday with the Ryanair crew would be fun, because they look filthy. BA, you go, oh, yeah, no, it'd probably be, you know, it'd be walking holidays somewhere. But the Ryanair crew, that would be sunsea and sangria.
Three tables in the upright position, if you know what I mean. Yourselves. It is the sort of plane where it's delayed and then a man comes on with a spanner and you think, oh dear God.
I think O'Leary's got a very strange attitude to things. He's always got this sort of slightly Gerald Ratner quality to his pronouncements. Has never quite gone far enough to send himself. This one, he said the situation is clearly a mess, but 98% of passengers are unaffected, which, like, in airline terms, they said 98% of this plane is not currently on fire. Oh, that's relaxing enough, isn't it?
At least we're not like the Japanese crashing their planes into ships and all that shite. It's an honour thing with them, tis.
And he said, oh, you know, it's fine because people will still book with us because we're cheap. And the awful thing is that, yeah, of course we will. It's British people love a bargain more than we care about. I mean, if you said it's cheap but the wing might fall off, then most people go, oh, but how cheap?
This is the latest news from Ryanair, who have cancelled more than 2,000 flights after a cock-up over the rostering of their pilots. Ryanair is now said to be desperately trying to save its reputation, which sounds rather like a case of shutting the stable door after the horse has set up an absolutely appalling airline company. The crisis prompted a defiant press conference from Ryanair boss Michael O'Leary, a man who has taken the concept of no frills and extended it to his own personality. Michael O'Leary claimed that passengers who were boycotting the company would eventually return due to its low prices, upholding Ryanair's commitment to providing its customers with a heady mix of low-cost travel and sheer unadulterated contempt. 2 points to Sarah. And at the end of round one, the scores are Sarah and Lucy have 4, but Jeremy and Daniel have 5. We start round two with an excerpt from South Africa's Cape Times newspaper.
The South African National Defence Force has launched an investigation into an accident at a military base in which, during a fire prevention exercise, 83 military vehicles were completely destroyed by fire.
Thanks to Robin Mosley for sending us that. Lucy, which cable is attempting to reach a broadband?
Oh, very clever. Well, now, this relates to what I think we'll all agree, the television treat of the year, which was the coverage of the Lib Dem conference in Bournemouth. It was like Game of Thrones on crack. It was extraordinary. you know, the Lib Dem conference, always dull. It's like, to be honest, though, I quite liked watching the Lib Dem conference this year because it was like with potential nuclear Armageddon, the Tories imploding. The Lib Dem conference was like a lovely sort of palate-cleansing sorbet of dullness in between everything else. All the great Lib Dems were there. There was Tim Farron was there, Joe Swinson was there. it's hard. It's like trying to name famous Belgians, isn't it? You know... Lib Dems you've heard of. If you get to five, then, you know, write in and I'll send you a book token. well, Vince Cable was there. Vince Cable is now apparently the leader of the Lib Dems. Who knew? I was thinking about this, and I think, you know, like in the Tories and Labour Party, there's people jockeying for position, desperate to be leader. I think with the Lib Dems being leader, it's more like jury duty. where everyone has to have a go. I think Vince Cable probably thought he'd got away with it. He was like, oh, I can probably retire, never having had to do it. And they were like, no, Vince, it's your turn. Come on, you can't be worse than Tim was. Vince Cable said it's perfectly plausible that he could become Prime Minister. And you can tell Vince Cable doesn't really want to be Prime Minister. All he wants to do is have a nap and watch Homes Under the Hammer.
I was involved in the last days of the SDP. And in fact, so we ran in a by-election at one point and the person who was running the by-election ran into headquarters and on the phone and said, we've scored, the winner of this by-election scored 74.73%. And the headquarters said, you don't actually need to give it to two decimal points. And she said, oh, I do, otherwise we didn't get anything. And I turned up to the last conference of the SDP and I overheard a TV commentator going, if we can make the commentary bad enough, we won't have to come back next year. and it was indeed the last... And on the very, very last moment of the conference, I was on the platform. We all stood up and because we moved our chairs back, we knocked the set over. And that was the end of the SDP.
Vince, Kate, the thing about the Lib Dems is they're a completely busted... I mean, they just haven't noticed that people are absolutely furious with them. And Vince Cable, who did, to his credit, forewarn the country that the banks were going to crash because they were not regulated, once he was in government, didn't mention that the banks had crashed themselves, was happy to carry on with the lie that Labour had somehow caused an international banking crisis. And he was the last Liberal that anyone had any remaining affection for, and then he privatised the Royal Mail. And now he's just got the demeanour of somebody who knows he's about to do something that he knows is wrong, and he's getting his belligerence first. My message to the country is, stop me before I kill again.
Have you covered Lib Dem conferences as a journalist?
I've been to lots of Liberal Democrat conferences. I don't go anymore. It's really embarrassing. Matthew Paris said that he's been for years, and so therefore he still goes because he feels it would be mean not to.
Because this one was quite sparsely attended, wasn't it? It wasn't like the hall wasn't full for Cable's big speech.
No, it's really difficult. It is very difficult for journalists to cover week after week of conferences. So they're quite happy, like, you don't have to go to UKIP anymore. Now you don't have to go to the Liberal Democrats. So soon they'll finish off the Tories and then I'll just have to go to one.
I do think it is genuinely difficult, as you say, to make centrist policies sound sexy. Really, if you want to get noticed now, you just have to be an abomination of a human. If Vince Cable really wanted to get noticed, he should have just walked on stage in leather trousers and strangled a squirrel or something. And then, like, 75 million people would have clicked on it. And of those 75 million, like, 7% would go, I think he's showing leadership material.
I ran for Parliament as a SDP and Liberal candidate. I was only 23 years old at the time, basically much too young to be a candidate. I've got a letter at home from the Citizens Advice Bureau saying, Dear Mr Finkelstein, it was so nice to meet you, comma, and your mother.
This is Vince Cable's first speech as party leader at the Lib Dem conference, which took place this week in Bournemouth. Cable is 74 and came out of retirement last year to become party leader, which explains why the speech began with him asking, mind if I turn your heating up, before segueing into a lengthy and, to be honest, somewhat repetitive story about wool. Vince's speech was met by an enthusiastic round of applause, despite how dangerous it is to wake someone up who's essentially sleepwalking.
The conference was sparsely attended. At one point, Vince got a standing ovation when one chap got up to use the bathroom and another stood up to let him pass. Given the state of the Lib Dems in Westminster, Vince Cable can now count on the support of basically 12 people, so much like Jesus, and another underrated visionary who rose from the dead to preach social justice before dying alone on a wooden cross because no one could forget that time he lied about tuition fees. Also at the party conference, hawkers were selling £5 laminated photos of former leader Tim Farron, which make a stylish addition to any homemade shrine. or, at a pinch, makeshift waterproof lining for a medium-sized litter tray and an unfussy cat. 2 points to Lucy. Danny, who do we now have an extra reason to call His Royal Highness?
Well, this will be the Duke of Cambridge, who was this week asking for expert advice on whether drugs should be legalised. I'm not allowed to insult the royal family, actually, because my grandmother used to always regard that as having come to this country as the sort of symbol of stability. And she used to have a saying, which is, while the Queen is safe in Buckingham Palace, we are safe in Hendon Central, which was sort of the root of my politics. But
Well, what do you think? I mean, he must know about drugs. I mean, he's got money. I mean, he did spend his youth hanging around on huge estates. No prospect of any worthwhile employment. In fact, generations of jobless in that family. You know, guns everywhere. It's just dysfunction, isn't it, the whole thing?
I read the article, and the article sort of described what had happened, and they said, you know, that Prince William had visited a drug addiction charity and had asked the assembled group for their thoughts on drugs legalisation. He gave no opinion on the topic and he thanked them and went home. That's an article about a grown man making chit-chat. It's this thing about the common touch. It's like people are just so excited when a royal doesn't demand someone go and get them a sandwich or behead them or something.
Yeah, but William and Harry are really good at it now. I mean, they've revived the royal family because they just pose as normal people. When they meet normal people, say, yeah, soccer's great, isn't it? We call it kick rugby. It's great. I don't understand why you don't pick the ball up and run with it. Is it something to do with social housing?
This is Prince William's visit to a drug addiction charity in Spitalfields, where he asked recovering addicts if they thought drugs should be decriminalised. It's possible that he may have overestimated his influence on these issues, given that for the rest of his life, the most important decisions he will have to make will be about what kind of hat he wears on a balcony. I suppose that if Prince William's been going to East London and asking about drugs, that makes him very much the Prince Harry of the royal family. We don't know if the royals have an official dealer or whether this is yet another role assumed by Prince Andrew for purely ceremonial purposes. All of this does raise the very real possibility that when the Queen asks the public, and what do? She could be asking an entirely different question altogether. 2 points to Danny. Jeremy, who's been peering at some expenses?
The Electoral Reform Society's been looking at expenses of the House of Lords, and I can't remember all the figures, but there were a number of members of the House of Lords who had spoken fewer than five times in a year, and yet their total expenses came to something like £4 million, and apparently you can get £300 a day just for turning up. The thing is, though, when you consider the 24-hour care that the House of Lords provides, if we had to look after these people in their own homes, I think it would actually work out more expensive. So, really, I mean, and it's a wonderful thing. If it ever comes on the telly, it's a bit like EastEnders. You think, oh, my God, I thought he was dead. Norman Tebbit takes over the Queen Vic. It's like, you slag. You're not family.
How many hereditary peers are there now? Danny, is this your area of expertise?
To 82 to 92, I can't remember.
Because now the sort of makeup of it, we used to think, well, it was sort of mad old people or whatever, and then they had the sort of hereditary peers thing, and I thought, yeah, it was quite a good idea getting rid of hereditary peers. I think that's, but you didn't think it would be a good idea because they would then be replaced with people like Alan Sugar and Karen Brady or whatever. If you think, hang on a minute, what's going on? Eventually they're going to have contestants from The Apprentice taking up seats in the House of Lords.
Yeah, they've replaced hereditary peers with hereditary disorders, basically.
You talk about the hereditary peers. It's quite a weird experience being called Finkelstein and coming into the House of Lords, and I got an email from somebody called Markesov, and I thought it was someone from my synagogue, actually, and then I read it again, and it said, Markesov Lothian.
Well, say they're lazy, but, you know, you can't blame them for all that leaping they do at Christmas, really.
This is a report into the House of Lords which reveals that peers who have spoken only five times or less in the chamber in the last year have nevertheless claimed a total of more than £4 million in expenses. The study analysed over 700 peers' expense records, which must have made extremely compelling reading, if your idea of extremely compelling reading is 700 receipts saying, gin in a can. The House of Lords is, of course, where people go once they've served their useful contribution to public life and have nothing more to offer, so one shouldn't be too harsh on what is essentially democracy's Radio 4. One yearns for the days when lords would be rewarded by their tenants handing over a tenth of their fruit and veg and the virginity of their eldest daughter, before this was phased out in the late 1980s. 2 points to Jeremy. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting that they'd like to share?
This was sent in by an anonymous listener, and it's an excerpt from the Cannock and Rugeley Chronicle. The French Defence Minister, Florence Parly, warns that North Korea may be closer than previously thought to building missiles capable of hitting Europe, which is all the more reason to leave the EU.
Danny.
Pauline Porter saw this in the Daily Telegraph Your Money section regarding travel insurance. Direct Line said that it will cover medical claims and disrupted travel, but the baggage claims are assessed case by case.
Sarah.
Sam Godden and a few other listeners received an email from Dobby's Garden Centres this week with the following subject line. Massive member event starts tomorrow.
Lucy.
Grace Fenwick saw this in a local paper. It was about the actor Gerard Butler staying in Galloway recently while filming a new movie. It said, Butler made a surprise visit to a community fair in Wigtonshire and even tucked into a delicious pancake made by a volunteer. Straight afterwards, Butler made an unplanned visit to the wards of Galloway Community Hospital.
Thank you. Now let's take a look at the final scores. Sarah and Lucy have 8, but this week's winners are Jeremy and Daniel with 9. Before we leave you, here is an email subject line from a BBC newsletter sent in by Trevor J. Saxby and dozens of others.
What makes a psychopath? Strictly stars hit the red carpet.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Jeremy Hardy, Daniel Finkelstein, Sarah Kendall and Lucy Porter. In the chair was Miles Jupp and the news was read by me, Zeb Soames. The chair script was written by Madeline Brettingham, Max Davis and James Kettle, with additional material by Daniel Grufferty and Jenny Lavelle. The producer was Joe Nunnery and it was a BBC Studios production.